This week on the Back Table Podcast.
For us to normalize this, we got to entertain tons of conversations, hundreds of them, thousands of them. And then when the need comes, the people know exactly what to do. It has to be that personal experience. And by the way, in those orientations, when I would hear a physician coming in, moving into town, brand new, and saying, you know, my wife has just been diagnosed with breast cancer or something, I'm putting this on my phone, and in 2 months, I'm calling that physician. I'm actually making a personal call to say, how is it going? How did the treatment go? How are you doing? How is she doing? That's the kind of caring that we would deploy preemptively and in an intentional way to say, your humanity and your life outside of this hospital matters to us here. You matter as a human being, not just as a surgeon, not just as an MD or a physician.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Back Table ENT Podcast, where we discuss all things ENT. We bring you the best and brightest in our field and hope that you can take something from our show to your practice. My name is Tony Shane, and I'm a pediatric otolaryngologist at the University of Tennessee and affiliated with Labanor Children's Hospital and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And today, I'm fortunate enough to have Dr. Julie Way and Dr. Hurley Paolini to talk about physician and specifically surgeon burnout. And you all have heard Dr. Way on this podcast before. She is actually a big inspiration to me in terms of wellness and mental health, specifically in physicians and surgeons. And I'm fortunate to have gotten to know her over the past couple of years. And I reached out to her and Dr. Shaw about this podcast. And I was thinking, why have we never talked to a psychologist about this? So somebody who is a mental health expert. And this is in no small part to me being married to a psychologist and being a very, very big proponent of mental health for all medical specialties. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Way and Dr. Paolini, and thank you for taking the time on this Sunday to talk to me. And first off, how do y'all know each other?
Thanks, Tony. First of all, I was just thinking, what an unfair advantage. You're married to a psychologist. I mean, no disrespect to my amazing husband. Perhaps we start, you know, you and I know each other well. I wonder if Dr. Paolini, maybe you can introduce yourself before we tell our story of how we know each other. Is that okay, Dr. Shen?
Sure.
Yeah, of course.
I'd be happy to. So I'm Hurley Paolini, and for the past 35 years, I have worked solely with physicians. And so I've been so privileged to have a front seat to the whole issue that involves not just physicians in general, but surgeons in particular. So that's, you know, my practice is dedicated solely to that and to consulting with healthcare systems, helping them to set up programs that would be helpful to physicians and to surgeons.
Yeah, I'll share a little bit about what a gift and the trajectory of my life and well-being changed when I had the privilege to meet Hurley. I think we were, well, in my last organization, when I was with Nemours in Orlando, there was distinctly, I want to say it was summer of 2018, we were just discussing that. She was an invited speaker. She has published a beautiful monograph, Inside the Mind of a Physician. And I remember hearing her speak. And of course, you know, shy Julie Way waits after the talk to approach the speaker, because I just knew there's a whole lot I want to learn from this particular individual. Whatever she spoke about clearly resonated. It was impactful. And that was our first time meeting. And then in 2019, I had the opportunity to lead a small task force to create the ACGME well-being component of the as a mandatory component as the organization was starting a brand new pediatric residency. So even though I'm a ENT surgeon, because I think by then folks knew of my passion and my desire to keep creating collaborations and improve the experience for everyone, that's where I definitely worked with Hurley in more ways than we probably can remember and had a formal program implemented for the hospital, the medical staff, the residency. There was multiple components that went into effect in June of 2019. And then before I give the floor to Hurley, I think the last two comments is some days all the time, you just know that God, Buddha, universe knows more than you do, right? No one saw the pandemic coming. Whatever we had in place, wow, I can't even begin to talk about how thankfully we had that in place before the pandemic started. And we can go into the components of it, but thank you, Hurley. I'm forever a different person, different, you know, physician and surgeon because of your expertise.
You are very kind, Julie. It was really my privilege to partner with you and to learn from you as well. So together, I think we pretty much set up a program that was sort of like the star of all programs, if I must say. And with all humility, we put together, you know, several components that addressed multiple factors. And that's what I believe we need to do if we are to really be serious about this issue.
Well, thank you both for that introduction. And I have a number of questions I'd like to ask both of you. The first one, we've all heard about the causes of burnout, but I just want to get Dr. Paolini's take. What do you think are the leading causes of burnout in surgeons? What have you come across that we may not be thinking of?
So I'd like to take two tracks when I'm talking about this issue. One is the individual issue that belongs to surgeons. It has to do with starting in medical school. It has to do with their training. It has to do with the fact that we split off from surgeons and from all doctors, actually, some of the things they need to actually navigate this current very complex environment of practice. And so a part of this belongs to the individual, but really it's laced in terms of medical education, in terms of training formation for doctors. It starts pretty early on. The other part I'm going to say belongs to the organizations where they work. There's nothing more frustrating than those pebbles in the shoes of these surgeons, you know, things like, you know, broken processes in the OR, things that can be fixed and yet no one is attending to. And we just keep doing the same things over and over again, getting these sort of swords in the feet of the people, when in fact, it could be really just something that runs much smoother. Third and not last is the whole issue of this is not just science. When you're dealing with people's very complex issues and people not at their best, you're talking about meaning, purpose, healing. And for healers to actually be in a position to really understand that, we have to transform the entire system to actually be nurturing meaning and purpose like they do the whole thing with clinical sort of, you know, evidence-based medicine. This is evidence-based medicine that we do not leave our souls at the door of hospitals and ORs, that we actually have whole people doing the delivery of care.
Do you find that when surgeons or doctors take this situation and try to own it and try to make it better, that their feelings of burnout or not feeling heard go away? And I'll give you an example of what I mean is, I feel like I work in a relatively nurturing environment, but like every OR, especially during the pandemic, there were some things that needed to be ironed out. So what I could do in the beginning is I could control my operating room. So we instituted Cookie Monday, where on my OR day, we have, we circulate among anesthesia, the nursing staff, and the surgical staff, and we buy cookies from Crumble for all of the ENT rooms. And like automatically you walk into that OR expecting a sugar high around 11 or 12 p.m. and that caused the mood to go up. And from that, we managed to turn it away from we go in and work to our colleagues to we go in and work with our friends. And I have been fortunate to where my surgeon in chief became the president of the hospital. And while he was the president of the hospital, me and another colleague have been doing some of that surgeon in chief work. And we've taken what we've done for our own services and try to institute it and to create a happier environment in the OR for everybody. And that took feelings of frustration away from me to where I'm looking forward to going into work on Monday at 7:30, whereas I'm like, oh my God, here is another week of work. And like, how long am I going to be in the OR today? Do you feel like owning the situation and trying to make it better in a small step helps get rid of these feelings of burnout and frustration?
Yeah, if I may, I want to comment on that. First, kudos to you, Tony, right? For being a model and demonstrating that every single day we do have choice and actions we can take. It is very easy in human nature, right, to complain, to suffer, but not think outside the box or do what's within your control. And I would say that our culture hasn't helped necessarily foster that. And so the practice of medicine, surgery, when 3/4 of physicians are employed by systems, is often this continual, we're losing autonomy. So for me, every single day, the question is, yep, you're frustrated. Everybody's frustrated. That's the reality of U.S. healthcare, right? But what can you do? Because it is always in the doing, and in my experience, service of others. Even though I'm suffering, I'm really saving myself. But when I turn it over to how I can do that, that's oxygen, that's energy, that is that little bit of, instead of being a passive victim, you can become empowered, engaged, and then the ripple effects can be really huge because it's very contagious, isn't it? Once you elevate, whether it's mood, I'm not going to get into the sugar crash, but that's a different issue, right? I did the same thing without cookies, although in hindsight, maybe I should have done the cookies. I would do the little dance party at 2:45 during before shift change. Surgeons dread 3 p.m. because the shift change, your turnover time is a long time. There'd be a dance party with music. So what you just mentioned about mood is definitely important. The last bit, I want to go back to your first question. What are the leading causes, right? I mean, there's so much out there. Folks have heard podcasts, articles, read chapters. My consistent message and my epiphany was earlier when Hurley alluded to the splitting off. For me, you know, I'm older. I'm 53. To have gone through residency, fellowship, first decade of my career, when we still have fewer female surgeons, being a minority, the reality is I had to split off. The only way to survive the trauma, the second victim, the PTSD, the infertility, all the issues that affected me as a human being, the message to me early in my life and career and training is that there's no room for that, right? We cannot deal with that. You're a surgeon, right? Toughen up, prove to the world you belong. And it was that splitting off that made the suffering unbearable at some point. So now I would say the leading causes, it's not an academic cause. It's that the sooner we recognize all of us are, you know, fathers, mothers, sister, brother, daughter, you know, made up of a human flesh, blood, prone to illness, divorce, loss, emotion. Like there were just, it took a long time. And my goal of doing this work is to help everybody behind us and our current trainees and younger faculty and our colleagues, doesn't matter what career stage you are, to just embrace the humanity that and the humanness that we are. Otherwise, you know, we can talk about leading causes and you would have lots of literature saying these are the factors, but I think we kind of miss the point if we limit it to that.
I would second that in a couple other things. I would say we have to do this and that, meaning the individual and recognizing and integrating back the split off parts, which we really need to navigate the current environment and to take better care of ourselves. All those messages that had to do with don't do that, or, you know, this is not welcome here. We have to change all of that. And it's a lot we have to change. But we also have to have the kind of leadership now that doesn't just say, oh, this is healthcare in the U.S., I refuse to believe that this is the best we can do when we are not delivering the best care to our patients, but we're killing ourselves as we're doing it at the same time. We can do better than that, and we should. And we need to call our systems, and we need to absolutely work together to change that. I do want to go back to the granular piece, Tony, that you described. I was dancing here, actually, hearing the dance at 2:45. And also the Cookie Monday, all those things are amazing. But there are even more things we can do, such as the huddles that we start our days with the OR. We can bring inspiration to this place, and we should. As a psychologist, I would be neglectful not to mention that the human spirit needs inspiration, and that, in fact, when the brain is happy and inspired, it performs 30% faster and more accurately. Could we use that in our ORs? Absolutely. Right? When you're doing Cooking Mondays, this is not just a sugar high. This is about people understanding you care for them and that you are spending time actually buying something and bringing it in and saying, we matter, right? And together, we're going to do something that helps our endorphins to sort of be in a different place. Sometimes a small thing like a short story or an inspirational quote or something, especially coming from a surgeon, can do amazing things to your team. So I don't underestimate that. While I'm inviting the U.S. healthcare system to actually do better for their patients and their doctors and to actually take care of those things that are broken, I'm also inviting physicians to take the ownership the two of you are taking, which says, I own this OR, and here, this is how we do it. You're changing you're changing culture one cookie crumb at a time.
There are no crumbs left when we're done with the day.
Love it. I love it.
So I'd like to bring it back to a little bit of what you were talking about, Julie, as a woman and as a person of color. Now, fortunately, it looks like a lot more women are going into surgery. The majority of medical schools, although a slight majority, are women. And at my program, the majority of surgical residents are women as well, which is wonderful. But surgery for the long time was a boys' club. And even now, still, people say, like, suck it up and get on through it. So there is still, in my opinion, a very big stigma about bringing up mental health concerns, specifically in women, people of color, minorities, but even in men, where for decades, hundreds of years, men were supposed to be men and just suck it up, don't get upset. And I'm free to admit that when I cry with my patients, when I give them bad news, I feel better. I feel worse when I suck it up and don't do that. I feel a personal connection to them. How do we get over that stigma, which in my opinion is a very, very big cause of burnout? Because when you feel down, you feel anxious, you don't feel like you can go ask for help.
Wow. Tony, first of all, thanks for just being so authentic, right? This is how it starts. I always am a bit concerned if I ever say things by qualifying I'm a woman or I'm a minority or I'm an Asian woman, because the reality is you are correct. The fact is, there's hundreds of years of Caucasian male surgeons, right, who apparently model how it should be. So for you, you're growing up with that as the model of how you should be. So there's all these unspoken expectations and forces that does not give you permission, or you don't give yourself permission then, right? Because you're surrounded by watching other male, hey, very competent, renowned legacy surgeons, but you'll never see them being human, suffering, struggling. I'm not saying they don't. It's just, it's not, we don't see that. So then we judge ourselves like, well, we must be weak if we do all that. So thanks for pointing that part out, especially about as we continue to expand gender, race, ethnicity, diversity, that's beyond that for our own specialty. I will just comment a couple things that most listeners may already know, right? If we get caught, very academic, women as human beings, and female physicians, this has been shown in multiple studies, we experience a higher degree of emotional exhaustion. That's because we express more emotion. We carry more emotion. This is our entire existence and how we experience that. I will say that just the lack of variation in what we were taught, like now it's blended career types. It's not just academic and private practice, right? One person, no matter where they are, they could do clinical care, some research, some education. It's that variety. As long as you have a niche and some protected time to do what you're interested in, aligns with your passion, I think that's what minimizes it. But fundamentally for me, Tony, because I come with my trauma, barriers, critical inner voice, and as do you, and we come from different background, what I've learned that Hurley helped teach me to make big scale culture change, it takes time to get people around you. So when I'm suffering and I'm not clearly, I can't see it because I'm in it, I'm not giving myself permission to call a timeout or ask for help. My colleagues around me saw it. and they activate help for me. The day this started happening for us, because Hurley and a team that she ran manned an immediate access line 24/7, 365. That was above and beyond your employee assistance line, and here's the hotline that no one's answering. I saw the difference within months when people started calling the line for each other. Because I got to be honest with you, I can do all the podcasts, write all the articles. I'm still bad at it, and I'm still at risk to myself. So I'll stop there and let Hurley comment.
Wow. I'm just a bit speechless. Thank you, Julie. Such vulnerability from both of you. You asked the question, how do we change this game, right? This is how, actually. With the courage you're both displaying to actually speak about your own experience and to be this vulnerable, taking this kind of a risk, this is how the culture is changed. It isn't the trauma that makes us sick, it's our inability to speak about it and to process it or to have forums like this where we can get real, right? We can be vulnerable and real. This is how the game changes. But you mentioned, Julie, something that actually kind of changed the game in that one organization, you know, that we were attempting to help. It was the sort of individual physician orientation. That is a game changer for any organization that really wants to address this issue. Meaning every physician joining the medical staff, every chair, every, you know, division chief, everyone gets to sit with a psychologist like me for at least a half an hour at, you know, at the beginning of said program. Okay. For us to normalize this, we got to entertain tons of conversations, hundreds of them, thousands of them. And then when the need comes, the people know exactly what to do. It has to be that personal experience. And by the way, in those orientations, when I would hear a physician coming in, moving into town, brand new, and saying, you know, my wife has just been diagnosed with breast cancer or something, I'm putting this on my phone. And in 2 months, I'm calling that physician. I'm actually making a personal call and just say, how is it going? How did the treatment go? How are you doing? How is she doing? That's the kind of caring that we would deploy preemptively and in an intentional way to say, your humanity and your life outside of this hospital matters to us here. You matter as a human being, not just as a surgeon, not just as an MD or a physician.
This was going to be my last question, but since we're talking about it now, I'm going to move it up to my next question is, how do you get a large organization to start implementing these processes and showing that they're important for the success of your organization, even the initial upfront cost, because this will cost money? How do you get your organization to see it? And what are the roadblocks that you've encountered and how to overcome those roadblocks?
Well, we can comment on that. Hurley, do you want to go first or would you like me to?
Let me start and then, okay, if you don't mind,
please,
you know, tagging with me. We both can speak for hours on this issue probably. And so I'm going to try and be very brief. It is like climbing Mount Everest. Now, you think it should be easy, right? Because everyone's suffering from this. It's a pandemic, actually, the issue, and it's hurting everything. We're losing physicians. We are absolutely harming the clinical care. I could go on, and this is research-based. We know what is happening as a result of this. And yet, organizations really just want to check a box. I don't know how many organizations call me to make a presentation that is like 15 minutes long, and they want the issue solved in that time frame. Okay? This is medicine for you. It's like, you know, just like take the x-ray, do this, and we're done with that. We're just checking a box. Until people really understand the cost of this and the fact that any organization that figures this out is going to be in the cutting edge and be extremely successful and highly competitive, I don't think we're still really in the early stages, even though it's 25 years after I designed the first program that was attached to a hospital. So I'm sorry to say that. I don't say that to discourage anyone. But the encouraging part is this. We have to translate it into dollars. Now, this is not my usual saying because I'm an idealist and I want people to understand the beautiful landscape we can create together. But unless we translate this into dollars, then people at the C-suite doesn't really quite, they don't get it. And so I've done just that. One of the things we did is to translate retention into dollars. And in 2 years, we saved $2.5 million just retaining physicians. That can get the attention of the C-suite now.
Hardly, yeah, you're being humble. I know you could give an entire course. And you do, actually. You run retreats. You've worked with many health systems. And I humbly have no formal training, right, or playbook. Tony, I'm your colleague in PT&T. I'm blessed to have had leadership roles to grow myself and try to support others. I think from the system perspective, you know, how do you get someone? Well, I think you have to build a case. The same way we have to create a pro forma. I want to hire another advanced practitioner. We want to recruit another surgeon, you know, get a nurse, whatever it is. That's the language I've been attuned to speaking the last decade, right? So in my case, that this last experience, sometimes you're lucky. I mean, the need just arose while I'm over here banging, screaming, waving a flag, going, listen, we need this. And for me, it just happened that, you know, if you're going to launch a residency and it's an ACGME mandate, it's really not an option, right? Prior to the mandate, I think it's all, but I do want to point out, as I've been humbled to get invited to speak with various training academic programs around the country, not everyone has the same implementation of a program. So you can just end up going, oh, two lectures on wellness, check, versus what she and I are talking about, which is a profound transformation of, it can't be one or two doctors saying well-being matters. It's got to be top down. So there, I think a big thing for me, it was just the one, there were dollars that supported this initiative. Two, I humbly will point out, I pray that listeners at their organization, there hasn't been a physician suicide. I can tell you right now, if there has been at your organization, it's hard to pretend that didn't happen. That is a very devastating loss for colleagues and people. So that's another, you know, if no one was listening then, when something tragic like that happens to a medical staff, physician, or advanced practitioner, then we really somebody needs to examine the way we do risk management for a sentinel event or a bad outcome, right, at the organization and the resources you have or don't have. I think, again, yes, having the senior people, the chairs, the chiefs, meet with a psychologist so they understand. Maybe they themselves think it's great. I've even met people that tell me they don't believe in burnout, and they're in a very high physician leadership role. There is nothing more discouraging and devastating than for me to hear that. And I'm very judgmental. Wow, this is not about you. But if you don't believe it exists, then good luck to getting dollars and support for that. I think the opportunity then to create a medical staff function in the infrastructure, to have a medical staff wellness well-being committee, that is a game changer. I learned a lot through the opportunity to lead that for 3 years. So you start, you know, and now, listen, I'm late to the party. I now am grateful in organizations I now belong to and I'm affiliated with where that's already robust. So you have representation. It has to be fundamentally engagement and accountability from within. And then, you know, you got to track, you got to have data. We're in a data-driven world. So as Hurley alluded to, whether you're measuring financial impact to turnover, percentage of turnover relative to national benchmark, I mean, we're not reinventing the wheel. That stuff is all there. It's a matter of where are you? Who are your leaders? Are they attuned to the reality? You know, I guess if your organization has no turnover and everybody's super happy and your burnout survey says no one's thinking about leaving because they're so happy, then good for you. But if it's what I think most places are, then the question is what can be done to address that?
I would venture to say, Julie, there are no places, actually. I do consulting with all kinds of organizations across the country. There are no places that could really honestly say that they have no burnout in their midst and that everyone's happy. That is really just a fantasy. They are not measuring it.
Yeah. And then before I give it back to Tony, I, you know, Hurley, you know how passionate I've been about taking more risk and expanding the boundaries of the conversations we have. So in particular, I want to go back to what we shared about otolaryngology now being over 30% female. I have been very focused to ignite conversations through panels, national meeting forums, to really talk about contemporary challenges in family planning for trainees and young faculty. This is including infertility, miscarriage, delaying pregnancy, and now the topic of cryopreservation is highly relevant for trainees and young faculty. And I just find that if we don't give ourselves permission and create space to tackle all this and give the trainees a chance to speak their truth and their experience and then bring in expert information that if left to their own to navigate, would just take years at a price that they shouldn't have to pay, all by choosing a noble career of medicine and service of others. So I will tell you, I'm super energized again. Last year was the first time I put on such a panel. The outpouring of validation from colleagues, women, trainees in tears, through text, through emails of people just pouring out saying, wow, we need more of this, we need more of this, and that's our goal.
So that actually leads me to my next question is, how early should we start these interventions? Should we start them when they are residents, when they are attendings, when they are medical students? Because I personally don't think I really realize the amount of stress that people go through when they're applying to a competitive specialty like ENT, which is often ranked 1, 2, or 3, depending on the year. And when I think our most recent match rate was under 50%. And I paid attention a lot more this year to the stress, because, well, this is the first year we've had it in person since the pandemic started. So I feel like these kids are stressed. I don't think it's normal for a fourth-year medical student to come in with 20 publications. One, how much work did they actually do on it? Two, if they did so much work, they are probably tighter than a rubber band. So do we intervene, especially in these people who are applying for competitive specialties, like from the get-go, from day one in medical school, or do we wait until they come and see us?
Yeah, so I would say as early as possible. But you see, it's not just intervention. I don't want to be an ambulance at the end of the hill. I would like medical school and the whole thing about this competition and all that to actually be modified so that it is actually accounting for the human experience, right? Now, until then, we intervene as soon as possible and we do preemptive stuff. Like, I have a doctor who brought in his 2 sons who were, you know, actually just accepted in medical school, and he said, get them ready. And he was right. He was right. Get them ready. Help them to actually sort of like put out an antidote or whatever to set up the kinds of parameters that will help these 2 young men to do this in a different way than I did it. Now, that's pretty rare, right? That I get to do this kind of preemptive and preventive work. But that's my dream. That's my dream, is that we would understand that this kind of education, this kind of academic rigor, you know, takes a lot out of people. And the competition and that holding people's lives in your hands is an incredible proposition. And because of that, we're going to actually help you. Not with these talks that are kind of like some just pretend stuff about resiliency, because resiliency has to do with something much deeper than what we're talking about today. So I would transform the environments in these medical schools and in all of these residencies in order to account for the humanity of the trainees and in order to create the conditions for them to work hard, but to also be able to not be split off, to be whole while they are doing this. And I believe that's possible.
Yeah, well said, Hurley. Tony, I'd like to add to that. I've always been passionate about medical student education, learners, and this last decade have been a specialty advisor, right? So when you're at a school that doesn't have a home ENT program, the odds are against you. I know the odds more than the students. They don't know what they don't know. I know how competitive our field is. I want to integrate that with me as a mom. You know, our beautiful single child is a high school senior this year. So while I'm traumatized by the immigrant experience, the, you know, the the one that won the lottery because it was against all odds to have had the privilege of incredible education here and to have had the chance and a lot of times luck. It's like, how did I ever match? You know, I can't believe I match. I can't believe I'm an ENT. But now I can reflect going through having my daughter, right? The love of my life, you know, constantly battling. I want her to have opportunities. So yeah, I'm a tiger mom on steroid, but I also, she watches me burn out. She's like, I would never want to be a doctor. Look at you, you know, right? Sometimes we talk that way, but the reality is I watch highly performing, high competitive adolescent. And even if you're not, it's just what they're up against. I can't pretend, even though I can try to not be judgmental, but let's face it, I don't Instagram well. I don't know Snapchat. I don't know how socially they're oriented in how someone could hurt your feelings and bully you and unfriend you. And I don't know those things. What I do know is if I watch someone who's 15, 16, 17, my own child, under immense self-imposed pressure because of how competitive we just make everything is. And then I think about in med school, good news is step one, step two is pass or fail, right? I mean, there are some things that are globally being changed to try to appropriately assess competency. So it's not just, you know, it's not just time-based, that there's just so many components, and I'm not an expert in education. What I'm really trying to say is this, the bottom line is I'm still learning. Fundamentally, there are moments as a parent while living all these roles that I tell myself as a parent, and I have to make sure my child hears from me, as long as you're okay, right? It's not about that grade. Like, you're, you know, Lou Holtz taught me, your performance is your performance. That's not who you are. And I think we have a really hard time separating that, right? As a surgeon, my identity is a surgeon. I didn't know that. I thought that was the most important thing. You know, to separate a bad outcome from surgery from meaning I'm a horrible human being who hurt somebody because I'm fundamentally flawed. Man, that's a whole episode right there. So all the message is this. Hey, I can't do this. We all need somebody like Hurley in our lives to help us create that separation of something so complex that has become our norm. We don't even think about it. We just like, okay, I got to get up and go to work tomorrow. You know, I'm late. What do I need to do tomorrow? You know, who needs me? Yeah.
So how do you balance your own mental health versus our need to be of service to others? Because that is something that I still struggle with. For example, I had the whole week off because we had snow and nobody's going to show up. But now I'm thinking like, should I have risked my life to go into work so I could see like the one or two people who would show up? And I probably deal with that on a weekly basis. Like maybe I need a day off, but I have 40 patients scheduled to see me in clinic that day. Do I take that day off because I want them to have me at my best, or do I go in to see them because at this point they're waiting 3 months to be seen? How do you balance that with your own needs versus the needs of serving somebody else?
I'm so glad you asked that question. Tony, I don't trust myself to choose what's best for me. I have proven time and time again that I will go with the path of least resistance, which is saying yes. I'm being honest, right? So I remember the day my daughter was maybe four, sick, fever, laying on the couch saying, Mommy, stay home. I tell the story. And I said, no, well, Mommy has to go to work because there's 30 little kids that are waiting to see Mommy and they're sick and they need me. And my daughter just looked at me and said, well, I'm a sick kid. Mommy, I'm a sick kid. And I cried all the way to work. I didn't call out. Okay, but that was 13 years ago, right? So two things. I am so grateful I have a new assistant. I finally do. And every single assistant I've had, the very first conversation I have as I get to know them is make sure they get to know me. And I say, I need your help. This is what's going to happen. I'm going to overcommit. There'll be too much. And now this year, my reality, you know, what a gift, but I'm commuting. I never thought I'd be in this situation and I'm not complaining. I work in Akron, Ohio. We live in Orlando. Claire's a high school senior. Constantly debating, do I have another day of OR and clinic or do I take the flight home? And because I'm going to start crying if I talk about this. I am agonizing for an hour trying to make a decision. And finally, my assistant, who I've just only known the last 3 weeks, she says, go home to your daughter. And it's almost like, how ridiculous to need a human being. I'm not trying to be a victim or a martyr, right? Another human being said, go home to your daughter. I'm like, done. Clicked and decided, gonna just release the OR day and not feel bad about it. And then that's not even enough, right? And then I transition and I come home and work doesn't end. And it's just, you have to embrace being uncomfortable and embrace that guilt head on and go, you know what? I shouldn't be surprised by the feelings of guilt, but it's all right. Because if I'm hurt, that's thousands of patients that'll never be seen. But forget the patients for a second. I'm the only mom and the only wife to my husband and my daughter and the daughter to my parents. And this is, you know, this is, I'm not good at it. I can't give anybody, I will tell you, we have to be each other's keeper. So Tony, you text me next time you're wondering, I will tell you. I'm very bossy. I will tell you what you need to do. Yeah.
Well, I've come up with a rule, not to be facetious, but it can't be an emergency to see me, because if it's an emergency, they need to go to the emergency room. And if it's not an emergency, then they can wait. So.
Love it. Hardly.
We don't have the time, but I would say this is that internal sort of complex stuff that comes from your training, that comes from years of sort of putting yourself last from the many bladder infections and UTI infections that female physicians have because they couldn't even go to the bathroom. So, I mean, it is so primal. It is like way back. So sometimes you do need a companion for the journey, somebody who will be watching out your back and ask just some open questions, right? To help you reflect. So your struggle is real and it takes time for us to arrive at the place of the old analogy where it's like, put your mask on first when you are in the airplane and the oxygen is needed, right? This is the equivalent of that. And you are the instrument of this practice, which means that if you're not at your best, like in your OR, you calibrate instruments, they have to be at a certain whatever, somebody has seen to that. In this case, you are the instrument. And unless you are totally well and have some kind of balance in your life, it's going to show up and you have no idea actually how the outcomes are impacted by that. So this isn't some selfish sort of endeavor. This is really about caring for patients and understanding that if you're not at your best, lots of things are not going to be at the best. And can we live with that?
I have to give an example because Hurley would be so proud of me for where I put energy Friday and Saturday. This last stretch of 7 day, 7 night call in a row, and now I'm division director, and it was very apparent to me, wow, in this new organization, no different. The calls, a lot of them middle of the night, all night long, every 60 to 90 minutes from the parents on the outpatient public side with no triage, no protection. Most of them were not even urgent or emergent. Then on the hospital side, I had an epiphany. Everybody that calls us and consults us work shifts. So they don't realize we don't. We work all day the next day. So I decided I'm going to launch a Save a Surgeon campaign, right? 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. So where I put my energy, I was really proud. This is just the beginning. I went ahead and wrote a humble, I'm sure a long email. You're forced to change if you don't want to get more long emails from Julie Wei. To the hospitalist director, the ER director, specific examples of patients, MRN, and why that call at 3 a.m, to me, representing our service, did not impact management, outcome, and frankly, nothing changed had they called at 6 a.m, right? And so by pointing these out, I'm always cautious, you know, you're kind of new. Don't come across because people will say, you guys are lazy. You just don't want to do your job because you're on call. But I just took a chance because I had to, because I'm not going to survive this. I had some health issues, barely made it through the 7 days. So the response was incredibly affirming. Not only, wow, thank you. we're going to go back to our teams. You're absolutely correct. We're going to review these things. We actually have a protocol in place. I guess people aren't using it. Can you come to our staff meeting? Clarify, explain, right? Happy to do it. I got that from both physician leaders. And of course, that was great. We'll see what happens. Fingers crossed. The next email today then went to the person directing all the hospital operator, right? I think the reality is we suffer, but people don't understand our reality. I think they're up, so they think you're up. They get off at 7 a.m. and go home to sleep, and they think you do too, right? So, and when we either can be passive and all complain about it and just keep, or we need to come together and say, hey, turns out protecting me is what protects patient safety. So I stop feeling embarrassed about putting my energy and intellect and proposals to affect system changes because too. So anyways, we'll see.
Right. Well, I have kept you for a long time on a Sunday afternoon. Do you, either of you have any parting words for our audience?
Oh, my first is gratitude. Gratitude for you for leading this, for entertaining conversations that we usually don't. That's how we change the game, right? And for those listening, I would say, join us. Join this movement to not just save a surgeon, but to save all doctors, right? And to transform the environment of delivering care. This is a crucial issue. And if we fix this, we are fixing some of what's broken in healthcare. So it's like 2-for-1.
Yeah. And my parting words to anyone listening is always this. If you are suffering, instead of judging yourself or trying to decide if you should or shouldn't be, you know, please call someone immediately. You can call a colleague, a friend, speak to your chief, your chair. It could be someone outside your institution. I mean, this is where 2 decades of membership in national societies, colleagues like Tony that I consider my friend, we all have those. They don't have to be in the same specialty as you. Call somebody, reach out. You're going to be able to get the support. And you know, I'm going to be able to tell a colleague if I think they really need to take a time out, right? Whatever it is to keep them safe, if it's that extreme or just to have somebody else who can be a little more objective than any of us can be when we live the life we live, meeting the demands of the work that is required of us. And Tony, thank you so much for just even reaching out and your commitment to yourself and those around you and creating this episode for us. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you both. You both are an inspiration, not just to me, but hundreds and thousands of surgeons, otolaryngologists, and physicians out there.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us at @backtableENT on Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter. Backtable ENT is hosted by Gopi Shaw
and Ashley Agan.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz with support from
Taylor Spurgeon Hess.
Social media and PR by Chi Ding.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kennebrew.
Thanks again for listening and see you next week.